everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries, and everything in between.
If you are as intrigued by all things true crime as we are, you are in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me. First of all, before we get started with today's episode, we just wanted to say a massive thank you for all of the amazing feedback that we've had on the first episode. We appreciate you all tuning in and listening, and for all your feedback. We've had listeners far and wide.
We had listeners from as far away as Portugal and even Canada.
So thank you guys all for listening. Keep listening, keep tuning in. Please follow, subscribe, leave reviews if you can. All of the support is much appreciated.
This week we are talking about a story that made international headlines in 1986. But before we start, here are a few interesting facts about that year.
So in 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after it lifted off from Cape Canaveral. The number one song in the charts was That's What Friends Are For by Dion and Friends.
Do you want to sing a bit of that, Josh?
That's what friends are for. And lastly, the biggest film in the cinemas was Top Gun, starring Tom Cruise. Before we get started, just a quick disclaimer. Obviously, this is a true crime show, and we discuss serious crimes, sometimes involving violence and sensitive topics. We do aim to balance respectful storytelling with light-hearted commentary and a bit of humour to keep things engaging, but rest assured, the humour is never at the expense of the victims or their families. So if you're here for bad jokes, interesting stories, and mine and my mum's very silly sense of humour, then please stick around. Viewer discretion, and maybe a sense of humour, is advised.
Right, everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. And this is the story of the disappearance and unsolved case of Susie Lamplugh. On the last Monday of July 1986, in broad daylight and in the middle of a working day, the unthinkable happened. Susie Lamplugh, a pretty 25-year-old woman, disappeared during the course of her work as an estate agent while showing a mysterious client round a house in Fulham. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Susanna Jane Lamplugh, known as Susie, was born on 3rd of May 1961 in Cheltenham, England, to parents Paul and Diana. She was bubbly, ambitious, and her father described her as charismatic. Susie worked for a short time as a beautician on a QE2 cruise line before pursuing a career in the property industry. She worked as a negotiator for a company called Sturgis & Sons and would show clients around available properties. She lived and worked in London and spent most of her free time with her boyfriend, Adam Lee Gart, as well as her family and friends.
I actually don't know this case at all. I know the name Susie Lamplugh. I'm guessing it's quite a big case, but I don't know any of the details, so I'm glad you've done this one because I'm interested to know what actually happened.
Well, you wouldn't know this case anyway because you weren't born then. You were born a few years later, but I remember living through this case and being a young woman of exactly the same age because she was born the same year as I was.
Which was what, 1931?
It kind of highlighted the risks to all young women of that time. We were all doing the same thing, going out to clubs and making our way home. And what makes this so different though is the fact that it was a normal working day for her. So it was in the middle, it was daylight hours. It wasn't, you know, the wee small hours of the morning really.
So I guess stranger danger wasn't really a thing back then.
I think it's always been a thing. I just don't think it was as highlighted or prevalent as much as it is today. We kind of lived in a more innocent time, even then in 1986. Things have changed drastically since then, I think. At 12:40 p.m. on the 28th of July, Susie had left her office, Sturgis & Sons, which was based at 654 Fulham Road, taking her house and car keys and a purse with £15 and credit cards, but leaving her handbag behind.
I think it's a bit strange that she would take what sounds like all of her belongings other than a handbag. Like, as far as I'm aware, most women put their purse in their handbag. They wouldn't just take a purse.
Her office diary recorded the details of the appointment as 12:45.
Oh, Mum, we're never going to be able to get through this, team.
Her office diary recorded the details of the appointment as 12:45, Mr. Kipper, 37 Shorold Road, O/S, which meant outside the property. The property had only been on the market for 1 week. Three witnesses saw Susie outside 37 Shorold Road between 12:45 and 1 p.m.
Hang on, can I just interject to say what an unfortunate name Mr. Kipper is?
Oh, don't say Mr. Kipper again. He'll set me off.
Also, just a side note. This is take 456 of my mum trying to read the one sentence with Mr. Kipper in because she cannot stop laughing at the name.
I just got Mr. Kipper out of my head and now you've put him back in again. A man walking home past the house saw her at the gateway of the empty property at 12:50 p.m. and she seemed to be waiting for someone, and we all know who that was. 10 minutes later, the owner of the house next door heard someone leaving number 37 and saw Susie and a man leaving the house and looking back up at it. The sighting was later the basis of an identikit of the unidentified male. The sighting of the pair standing outside the house was corroborated by another man who was walking past the property at around the same time. He noticed that the man was holding a bottle of champagne with ribbons around it.
Why would a guy who's coming to look at a property bring champagne with ribbons around it?
Well, this then kind of suggests that maybe there was some kind of celebration and maybe he was more than just a man viewing the property and had some kind of personal link to Susie, maybe.
Yeah, do you think that, well, it comes across to me that she might have known him, because if I'm going to view a property with an estate agent that I've never met before, why would I turn up with champagne with ribbons tied around it? That's something that would happen the other way around, isn't it? If I purchased the property, maybe the estate agent would turn up with a bottle of champagne for me with ribbons around it.
Maybe, but I think if we get to later on in the story, there are some kind of clues or connotations that they did actually know each other.
Interesting.
You know, prior to this event.
Okay. I mean, that would make a little bit more sense to me.
Witnesses reported that they then saw the pair entering a car, and the neighbour thought that the pair had been arguing before doing so. Witnesses described the man as a white male between 25 and 30, with a dark complexion and with dark hair swept back. He was immaculately dressed in a dark charcoal suit and was described as a public schoolboy type. He may have had a broken nose. You'd remember that, wouldn't you?
Well, you would remember that, yeah, and that's quite an identifying feature of someone, isn't it? You could say Mr. Kipling had a crooked nose.
Mr. Kipling? Doesn't he bake cakes?
Oh, Mr. Kipling. Did I say Mr. Kipling?
I don't know, but it sounded like it. Oh,
I think I did say Mr. Kipling. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kipper, sorry, Mr. Kipper with the crooked nose.
Oh, you have to keep saying Mr. Kipper. A man said that he had seen a couple arguing between 2 and 2:30 p.m. in the area. Again, that suggests that maybe they were familiar enough to kind of have like some kind of, you know, verbal discourse, kind of.
Well, again, I'm just trying to put myself in this situation. If I'm going to view a property with an estate agent, what would cause me to have an argument with them?
Exactly. It would more likely be something personal, wouldn't it, than, you know, I mean, what was it, that it didn't have like a tumble dryer or something?
Exactly. And even if something didn't and I wasn't happy, I'd just say, sorry, this property is not for me.
Exactly.
Thank you, goodbye.
Did they have tumble dryers in 1986?
You tell me, you lived there. Didn't you have to hand wash everything, hand dry everything?
And a mangle and all that kind of stuff, yeah. There was then a sighting of Susie driving her car erratically away from Shorold's Road, arguing with the man in the car, causing the witness to swerve to avoid a collision. So that argument then spilled out of, you know, from when they were outside the property into the journey away. Why was he in the car then?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Why would you get in the same car as the estate agent? So again, it's just opening more questions for me. And also, I'm assuming that other witness was in a car themselves to say they had to swerve to avoid the collision.
Yeah, but it sort of signifies that he knew it before.
Well, I'm certainly not getting into the car with an estate agent that I've never met before.
Susie's white Ford Fiesta was sighted poorly parked outside a garage opposite 123 Stevenage Road, about 1 mile away from the property, by several witnesses at various points in the afternoon. However, her close friend, Barbara Whitfield, insisted she had seen Susie driving north up the Fulham Palace Road in her car with a man at around 2:45 p.m.
Okay, so they've had an argument at the property, is what it seems. They've then gone into the car together, which sounds like they've gone into Susie's car. So they're both in the same car together, and now it's been found, or it's been sighted, weirdly parked, and another place about a mile away. So they've only drove 1 mile, which in reality is not that far.
No, and I think when the car was found as well, there was some indication that she had not actually been driving the car, because the driver's seat was pushed so far back that it would have been impossible for her to drive. Basically, as a woman, she was of smaller stature, so it indicated that a man had drove the car. I think the handbrake was off, disengaged, I think they said. It was parked erratically away from the curb and halfway across a garage door, so not the normal way that you would park a car. And that indicates again that there was some kind of argument or struggle, and it was parked very hastily in this location. But the question is, what happened after that then?
Yeah, so if the car was seen parked erratically at 2:45, it said that the other witness saw them arguing at about 2:30. So only 15 minutes has passed between both of these situations, the argument and then the erratically parked car.
Do you know what that says to me though? That when the car was parked, there was something going on, and she was taken out of that car and maybe got into another car.
Well, it sounds like they've exited the vehicle quickly and they haven't really thought about how they're parking it. They've thought about getting out the car.
It sounds to me that there was some kind of a struggle going on for a number of minutes at least, and it was just park the car and get it out of that car into another one where there was more control. If he was driving the car, this unidentified man, it makes sense, doesn't it? You know, that he's pulled up somewhere, maybe where his car was parked, away from the property, so that no one associated him with going into that property, and could not take down a registration plate or anything. And he's tried to maybe force her into his vehicle to exit the scene. That's my take on it anyway. As Whitfield was the only witness that day who actually knew Susie, her sighting was afforded significant weight. A woman living at 139 Stevenage Road also reported possibly seeing Susie with a smartly dressed man wearing a suit by the spot where her car was seen parked.
So that definitely adds weight to your theory that potentially, you know, he transferred it from one car to another if he was seen by that erratically parked car at that time.
Yes, but she didn't report any sign of a struggle, but that makes me think again that maybe he had some kind of control over it at that point. Did he have a knife or even a gun? By 3:30 p.m, Lamplugh's colleagues at the estate agency were becoming concerned that she had not returned. At 4:30, they travelled to 37 Shorrells Road to see if she was there, but she was not. At 6:45 p.m, her manager reported Susie's disappearance to the police.
Now, they've gone to the property at 4:30 to see if she's still there, and they've not found her. Why did it take them 2 hours and 15 minutes after that to then make the call to the police?
That was quick math, that, Josh.
That was quick maths. But that seems like a hell of a long time, to be honest.
I think probably what they were doing was they were trying to establish what other appointments she had that day and were checking them out. And by all accounts, they all did check out apart from this one mysterious man who was Mr. Kipper.
Okay, maybe it's not that long of a time then. To be honest, I think maybe, you know, if you were to go missing, I'd probably try and text everyone first.
I don't think you could text in them days, that's the point. I think it was a case of getting on the phone, checking out all of her friends and her family, you know, going through the work group first and checking all her appointments, I would guess, and then going a bit further afield, which is when they actually contacted her mother.
Yeah, I think maybe when you take all that into account, then it's probably that not that long of a time.
Speaking at the time, the late Diana Lamplugh, Susie's mother, vividly recalled the phone call she received from Susie's manager. He said, "Do you have any idea where your daughter might be, Mrs. Lamplugh? We wondered whether she could have called into home for lunch. I didn't want to worry you, but Susanna left to show a house to a client just before lunch and she has not returned." Diana recalled that it was so unlike Susie, who usually stuck to the rules and regulations, and her reaction was similar to many people facing a crisis. "My husband and I went down to where her car had been abandoned. We called, we shouted, and we encouraged our dogs to search for her."
I just think, imagine getting that phone call.
Well, you know what I'd be like.
Mum, you ring me 75 times a day anyway, so there's no chance I could ever go missing.
There's no chance any of you would ever go missing, because I'm like a private detective anyway, so I always know where everyone is.
I think you probably look into things in more detail than a private detective would.
Well, I just always assume that if you've not called after like 1 minute, 30 seconds, you're tied up in a ditch somewhere, or, you know, you've been kidnapped. And that's the because of all this true crime stuff, you see, it's had this effect on me.
I was going to say, guys, this is what happens when you are clinically obsessed with true crime. No, but I just think of you in that situation. If one of my employers was to call you and say, "Have you heard from Josh? he's gone, he's supposed to go here and we've not heard from him. It's unlike him.
Especially when you know that person so well that you know that's not normal for what they would normally do. At 10 p.m, a police officer found Susie's company car, the white Ford Fiesta, parked in the same spot at which it had been sighted that afternoon, which was by another house for sale. Was this someone familiar with the catalogue of houses from that estate agency?
Yeah, because to be honest, you could also maybe argue the fact that has she drove him to see another property?
Oh, good point. Never thought of that, actually.
And that could be a kind of disguise almost for this man.
That, yeah, that could have been a reason for him to get the two of them in the car together. The vehicle appeared to have been parked in haste as the driver's door was open. The handbrake was not enabled and the key was missing. The car was parked poorly and was partly overlapping a garage, which is what we said earlier on. Susie's purse was found in the car, but neither her own keys nor the keys to 37 Shorrells Road were found. The driver's seat was pushed back to a position from which she would not have been able to drive it to its current location.
So that's, again, that gives way to what you said earlier about potentially he was driving the car and not her. I mean, if it was in a position where it's not actually possible for her to drive, then there's only one answer to that question.
I think the fact that it says the car was parked poorly, it's definitely been parked just erratically in haste, really. And that, again, indicates to me that there was something going on in that car. It sounds to me the fact that the keys weren't found, that would indicate that she actually still had them on her person. So she's come out of that property. And as an estate agent, that's her most important thing, really, to keep hold of the keys. And whatever happened transpired so quickly that she's still got them in her hand, basically. Who knows what happened when she got into that car with this unidentified man? She's still got the keys. She didn't have time to pick her purse up. It's not that she wouldn't. If she was exiting a car to go anywhere other than show another property, she would have taken it with her, wouldn't she? She wouldn't just leave it there. So she's still got hold of those keys in her hand, in my mind, and didn't have time to even do anything else.
But then what about the car key? Why is the car key not there?
Did he snatch it out of the ignition so she couldn't drive away? Or, well, you know, attempt to drive away, because I don't think she was actually driving that car. Do you think that she knew him? To me, it all seems that it sounds too familiar that you would let a man that you don't know get into a car and drive you somewhere else. To me, there was some kind of connection there beforehand.
Or did she let him? Or did he say, or like you said earlier, maybe he had a knife and maybe he said, get in the car. Well, even if they did know each other, it didn't seem like it was a friendly engagement, did it?
No, but then why would you get into a car with a man that you don't know, that you're arguing with? So to me, that again suggests that she knew him.
Yeah, you know, she must have been familiar with him to get in the car with him.
Had she been on a date with him or something? Was she, you know, she's arguing with him, but she's not scared of him at this point. Police suggested that a black left-hand drive BMW vehicle may have been involved following an eyewitness account of a car of that description seen parked in Shorrells Road. That's quite significant, really.
Yeah, I mean, a left-hand drive, we don't have them in the UK. It's more of a European/international thing. And to get a left-hand drive car in the UK, it would have to be imported from another country or driven in from another country. So to me, that possibly suggests that he came from, not from England, not from the UK.
The man remembered seeing it because many cars in the road had been double parked, causing him some difficulty driving through the road. Another witness corroborated this account and said that he had seen the dark-coloured BMW parked almost outside of 37 Shorrells Road. So not only did someone have to sort of
drive around it?
Yeah, it was actually spotted very near to the property. A witness emerged some time later with another significant sighting. The witness had offered information after the disappearance, but his account was dismissed at that time because he had described a blonde-haired woman, and the police incorrectly assumed that Susie had brown hair when she vanished. She had had brown hair, but just prior to this incident, she'd had some of it sort of like highlights or something in, so it made it appear more blonde.
So it could have been taken as a blonde woman?
Yes, I mean, someone looking at it, I think when I see photographs of her, because she was a really nice looking girl, you know, and her hair did look more blonde.
But obviously they're probably going off older photos where maybe she was fully brunette.
Yeah, and then unfortunately that account was dismissed just on that basis, really. The witness was jogging when he saw a car speeding south down Stevenage Road, which was the same road in which Susie's car was later found abandoned. The car, which he noticed was a dark-coloured left-hand drive BMW, suddenly stopped further down the road, and a woman who matched Susie's appearance was seen struggling with a man inside the car and sounding the horn in an apparent attempt to attract attention.
So even if, let's say, okay, even if she did have highlights in her hair and someone's described her as a blonde-haired woman, surely as the police you would take that more serious than the sighting of a car.
Why did this witness not go over and help or phone the police or do something? Because, you know, if I saw a woman in a car struggling with a man, you're going to phone the police, aren't you, surely? I just don't understand why that didn't come out until later on.
That's a fair point, but I also think, from the police's perspective, why would they not look into that further, even if there's a chance that it wasn't Susie, but it might have been someone else? Well, it was someone else.
Yeah, exactly. You know, she's beeping the horn. She's doing everything to get help, basically. To me, that is too much of a coincidence. On the 29th of July, which was the day after Susie's disappearance, there was an article in the London Evening Standard headed "Kidnap Fears for Estate Agent's Girl." Scotland Yard reported there was grave concern for her safety. The 30th of July was Diana's 50th birthday, and the Lamplugh's home in southwest London was besieged by journalists. Diana and her husband Paul welcomed the media as a way of finding Susie, and they appeared twice on television, on BBC's Breakfast Time and TVAM's Good Morning Britain, articulating their fears for their daughter. Despite the biggest police investigation of the time and extensive media coverage, no information was forthcoming on Susie's fate. To date, Susie's body has never been found, but she has been presumed murdered and was legally declared dead in 1993.
So obviously there's been no resolution in the case, but they must have more evidence. They must have some reason to presume that she was murdered. And because who knows, it could have been an accidental death.
Well, someone would have had to cover it up, wouldn't they? So what you're saying is this mysterious man, I'm not going to say his name again, you know, was responsible for her death, but it may have been accidental because it couldn't just be an accident. She didn't die in a car crash or something, did she? And that accidental in that way. But if he accidentally caused her death, he would still then have had to cover it up, wouldn't he?
Yeah, true. And I think also the fact that no evidence was found in the car, no fingerprints, no blood, no DNA. How was that not the case? How has nothing been found? Or maybe they do have stuff and they're waiting to test it. I don't know. I guess back in 1986 when this happened, obviously the technology that they had for DNA and for fingerprint technology and blood analysis and all of the above wasn't as advanced as it is now.
I think as well, it indicates that obviously this unknown man was in her car with her, that he was some kind of professional criminal.
Yeah, I think that just comes down to whether they did or they didn't find anything in the car. If they didn't, then yeah, it would suggest some kind of cleanup. Okay, so obviously there was the biggest suspect in the case, which I'm assuming must have been the infamous Mr. Kipper. But was there ever anyone else that was suspected in the case? I know she had a boyfriend. I know obviously she obviously worked with other people at the estate agency.
There were never any real suspects in the case. There was a short list. Obviously, they always look closest to home, don't they? So her boyfriend would have been one of those, but he was cleared. But in 2002, Scotland Yard named convicted rapist and murderer John Carnahan as the key suspect.
Wait, is that how you say his name? John Carnahan.
Carnahan. It's not Cannon, it's Carnahan. Here's another Mr. Kipper situation.
Got that right, I'm John Carnahan.
Carnahan denied any involvement and police found no concrete evidence linking her disappearance to him. Let's talk about John Carnahan for a minute. John Carnahan was born in Sutton Coalfield, Birmingham on 20th of February 1954. He had a troubled childhood which stemmed from him claiming to have been sexually abused by a school teacher as a young boy. These events had a lasting effect and led to him suffering from severe anxiety, which in time led him to express much anger and resentment. Carnahan was in the Merchant Navy for 3 months, aged 17, then began working as a car salesman in his father's company.
Very interesting, considering that, I guess, the crux of this whole case seems to be the cars.
Well, it's all around this black left-hand drive BMW, isn't it? And I would guess that working as a car salesman, he's got those connections to actually be able to acquire something like that.
Yeah, and I would imagine that back in 1986, it probably wasn't as common to have left-hand drive cars in the UK, full stop.
No, but I don't even know how you'd go about acquiring one of those.
Well, I guess he would, considering he was a car salesman, so I guess he's got the the means to be able to make that happen.
Well, I think the least we can take out of that is that he definitely had an interest in cars and had the kind of setup to be able to get something like that. His life of crime started around the age of 14 when he indecently assaulted a woman in Erdington, Midlands.
14? That's so young to be committing crime just in general, but to commit an indecent assault as well, like when you're 14 years old.
I think what happened to him prior to this, though, was what kind of dictated his path. Starting from the late 1970s up until 1980, which was a whole decade, a series of mysterious and brutal rapes occurred in homes for sale in the West Midlands, where he was living at that time. The unidentified rapists specifically targeted homes on the market as estate agents and became known as, wait for it, the house for sale rapist.
I mean, I find that really interesting, considering that is basically the case we're talking about.
Yeah, it's too much of a coincidence there for me. Police now suspect that Canaan was responsible for these offences, and with good reason, I think. Detectives would later note that the offences bore all the hallmarks of his later crimes, and also noted the similarities to the disappearance of Susie Lamplu, who herself was an estate agent. Notably, Canaan showed up uninvited to a house that was for sale in Shorrells Road in Fulham, days before Susie was last seen there, believing that the young female occupant was alone in the house. He was acting strangely until the woman's husband appeared, causing him to quickly leave.
So it sounds like it's not the first time he's done this. He's going to unoccupied residences, hoping that, I'm guessing, a female estate agent might show up on her own. And then who knows what his plan was from there. But obviously this one that happened before Susie went missing, he didn't know that the woman's husband was going to show up.
Yeah, it wasn't just estate agents. He was just randomly, I think, going to houses that were for sale to look around, hoping that he could find a female alone. But more specifically, he actually went uninvited to a house in Shorrells Road where she went missing from.
Yeah, like you said before, it's far too much of a coincidence at this point.
It looks like he's been, for want of a better word, having a practice run several times. And unfortunately, Susie was the one where he completed his mission. In March 1981, during a robbery at a lady's knitwear shop, Canaan raped shop assistant Jean Bradford at knife point after threatening to stab his 17-month-old baby. After pleading guilty, Canaan was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for raping Bradford and a consecutive 3 years for 2 counts of robbery. He served 5 years of his 8-year sentence. 1 year after Susie's disappearance, detectives noted that the artist's impression of Mr. Kipper strongly resembled John Canaan, who was serving his sentence for the rape of Jean Bradford in a prison hostel outside HM Prison Wormwood Scrubs around the time of Lamplu's disappearance. Canaan had been on day release from the prison in the months preceding her disappearance and held a job in the area as a porter. In the weeks before she disappeared, Canaan had told inmates and workmates that he was visiting wine bars in Fulham and had met a new uptown girlfriend named Susu. Interestingly, Susie herself had been to some of these wine bars, including one located opposite from her office. Canaan confirmed in 2021 that he had visited the bar. In 2021, Canaan confirmed that he had also been to these bars and pubs and that he often delivered roses to women as a romantic ploy and had told people that he was interested in buying a property in the area.
I think there's so much to unpack just in that one part of the story, to be honest. So he was in a prison. Well, he was kind of on a release program from a prison in the area. He visited bars and pubs in the local area. He told friends that he had a new girlfriend called Susu, which I'm assuming is Susie, or he thought was Susie. And then also he used to use roses as a romantic ploy. And we also know that from the beginning of the story, when he turned up for the appointment with Susie, he'd came with a bottle of champagne, which, yeah, it's not roses. However, it is still, in my opinion, some kind of romantic ploy.
Yeah, he seems to be that kind of guy, doesn't he? Bringing the roses and flowers and wine and champagne. Probably some chocolates were thrown in there as well. I bet it was a box of Celebrations.
I would have went with a box of Thorntons myself.
I didn't think either of those were sort of... Oh, I think Thorntons was, because I used to buy them in St. John's Precinct. I used to like those bags of toffee with all the nuts in. Just in case anyone wants to throw any my way.
So to me, there's just so many things that are adding up. I mean, obviously at the moment, this is all circumstantial evidence. There's no concrete evidence, but, you know, 2 + 2 = 4.
Well, let's just look at some of the significant factors. He has got a prior record of criminal assault, specifically against women. He drove, as far as we know, a black BMW. Did he have a left-hand drive or...?
That we don't know.
Okay. He's got ties to being, you know, a car showroomer as a car salesman. So, you know, he was, as I say, well-placed to be able to do that kind of thing.
He was in the area at the time that this happened.
Yeah. He's got some mysterious girlfriend whose name sounds remarkably like Susie. He likes his romantic gestures, which Mr. Kipper was also seen to display.
And also he told people that he was, you know, looking to buy a property in the area.
In October 1987, 15 months after Susie's disappearance, John Canaan abducted and murdered 29-year-old Shirley Banks from Bristol. He had held Banks hostage in his flat for 18 hours before killing her and dumping her at a site in the Quantock Hills known as Dead Woman's Ditch.
That's a bit eerie, isn't it, that name?
Dead Woman's Ditch? Why was it known as Dead Woman's Ditch, do you know?
That's a great question.
Were other dead women found there, do you think?
Could be. I would assume so. That's a bit of a creepy name to have.
Yeah. If anyone knows what that is, please let us know.
If anyone's ever heard of Quantock Hills, please let us know.
But more importantly, Dead Woman's Ditch. Inside his dark BMW was found an imitation handgun, handcuffs and the tax disc for Banks's car. Soon after Canaan was arrested, Banks's car was found hidden in his garage, with the new false number plate affixed reading, get this, SLP386S.
Now, okay, so they found a fake gun in his car. They found handcuffs.
This is what we were saying earlier on.
This ties into what we were saying about potentially he's, you know, he's put Susie in his car. Even if someone pulls out a fake gun in that moment, you're not going to know that it's a fake gun, are you?
He's definitely had practice runs. This is someone who was ready to rumble. Detectives later noted that the letters SLP could stand for Susie Lamplew, and the number 86 for 1986, the year in which she vanished.
Come on. That is strange, however, I mean, it could also just be a license plate.
No, you don't get a license plate with SLP 86. What are the chances? You have to pay good money for them nowadays.
I mean, to be honest, it does actually say a new false number plate, which means it wasn't actually a real number plate, so he's obviously made it himself.
Yeah, so if he's going to make a number plate, I get that because he doesn't want his real number plate to be known. But why choose those initials and that number specifically?
He might as well have just got one made saying, I'm a killer.
Yeah.
At this point.
The media began to note the likeness between Canaan and the photo fit in the Lamplew case and speculated about a link between the Banks and Lamplew cases. It was also known that Canaan had joined a dating agency in Bristol weeks before he had murdered Banks, providing a false name of John Peterson, and had presented himself in a recorded video as a successful, smartly dressed businessman.
So these things, it's not looking good for Mr. Canaan here, is it, let's be honest?
No.
There's so many things that are just adding up and adding up, and I think, obviously, Mr. Kipper is not the person's real name. And we're now seeing that he's given false names before. He's now also putting himself across as a smartly dressed businessman, which we know is what witnesses have seen outside the property with Susie. So it kind of, to me, it just... there really isn't a better suspect, is there?
No, and the thing is, I've actually seen that video, that dating profile that he did, and there's no way you go out with him. He was getting all his words wrong, and he was just trying to portray himself as this worldly wise, affluent business type person, and you know, maybe some people fell for it, but you know, if he was on plentyoffish.com, I wouldn't be going for him, that's for sure.
Hopefully he didn't have a mole on his face.
Hopefully not. And why did he call himself Mr. Kipper? I mean, come on, you know, in all the, you know, if you look in the diary of that day for an appointment, you know, you've got like Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones, Mr. Williams, and you've got Mr. Kipper. He might as well have called himself Mr. Sardine.
But also, I wonder if he called himself a Mr. Kipper or if he actually gave a first name like Josh Kipper.
I think in them days, I think it was just, you know, it was a Mr. and Miss sort of kind of world, wasn't it? You know, now you wouldn't be able to say that, would you?
I could think of many better names than Mr. Kipper, to be honest.
Wouldn't you have thought of using something more generic, though? You know, as I say, like Jones or Smith or Williams, you know, Mr. Kipper stands out, doesn't it? But then there's a theory, you know, that the reason why was because those big Kipper ties were in fashion, kind of, or just going out of fashion. And
can you explain to me, because I'm not 900 years old, what a Kipper tie is?
You know, big people used to wear them. I can't even say this for laughing. In them days, did you wear like big wide ties and big like 10-toe shoes? Big wide shoes to match, to fit your 10-toes in. That's what they're called.
Right, we're going horrendously off topic here.
Metropolitan Police detectives travelled to Bristol to interview Cunnan about the Lamplugh disappearance. When he was asked by detectives if he understood the significance of the number plate, he replied that it could be seen as a reference to Susie Lamplugh, whom the detectives had not yet mentioned.
I mean, yeah, again, he may as well just say, listen, guys, I did it, because there's no... Why would you randomly just bring her name up?
However, Cunnan claimed that he had chosen the letters for the plate at random. He claimed that he had bought the car from a Bristol businessman who was responsible for the murders of Shirley Banks, Susie Lamplugh and another girl, and that the man was in a great deal of trouble. Cunnan was known for masquerading as a Bristol businessman. When asked if the man was himself, Cunnan provided an affirmative response, but immediately recanted and ended the interview because he was overcome with emotion. Cunnan was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of Banks and for several other rapes, abductions and attempted abductions. The sentencing judge told Cunnan, you should never again be at liberty outside of prison walls. Further interviews were conducted with Cunnan regarding Lamplugh's disappearance in 1988, 1989 and 1990. However, he was not placed on an identity parade.
Now, I find that a bit strange, to be honest, considering there were quite a few witnesses. Quite a few different people have said that they've seen a smartly dressed businessman with a blonde-haired woman, blah, blah, blah. I'm confused that they didn't do an identity parade with those witnesses.
I know, I don't know why they didn't do that. Because I think they would have definitely picked him out. Just going by the identity picture. Because they were so similar. And I've seen that as well, and they are really similar. So surely somebody would have been able to recognise him. So that was a bit of a...
That's a bit bizarre to me.
It's a bit of a falling down on the police's part, I think, though. In 1990, a woman named Jillie Page, with whom Cunnan had been in a relationship after Susie's disappearance, informed police that Cunnan had spoken about the Lamplugh case and told her that she was buried at Norton Barracks. Another former girlfriend of Cunnan, Daphne Sargent, also believed Cunnan to be responsible, saying, as soon as I heard about Susie, I knew it was John. It had all the hallmarks, right down to the champagne. He must have been spending a fortune on this champagne, this fella, mustn't he?
Yeah, I mean, like you've said a number of times, it seems to me like he was doing a lot of practice runs. He's obviously tried the same tactics with every woman that he's ever been involved with. And unfortunately for Susie, she was the one that he maybe took it too far with.
Well, I think that was his ultimate goal. I think maybe before that, were they just practice runs so that he could get to that point, or were they just sort of failed attempts where it's been, you know, something's happened and he couldn't complete it? I mean, these weren't random people, were they, just coming forward? These were girls who knew him, they'd been out with him, you know, had a relationship with him, so they knew what they were talking about. They knew all of these sort of tactics and ploys.
And his trademarks.
They were his trademarks.
And
exactly.
That again leans into the idea that potentially Susie did know him more than just a random customer.
In the years after Susie's disappearance, police tested the DNA of 800 unidentified bodies. I mean, that's quite shocking actually, isn't it? 800 unidentified bodies.
Well, the fact that there are 800 unidentified bodies is awful.
Yeah, I mean, there's 800 people, all who sort of... I've got relatives, you know, they've come from somebody, they've got a mum, a dad, you know, possibly brothers and sisters, and know what, you know, they're unidentified, so they've never been claimed by anyone. That is just really...
It's shocking.
Yeah, it is. These were remains that only matched Susie's description. So again, you know, they were just the ones that sort of lined up with what they were looking for, so God knows how many other...
That makes it even more awful that there's 800 people that, you know, obviously matched just her description alone.
Yeah, so there's probably many others, I mean, that don't match that description. So you could probably, you know, say four times that number at least, I would imagine. Susie was officially declared dead at her parents' behest exactly 7 years after her 1986 disappearance on the 27th of July, 1993. Oh, I'd just add our Jack then.
Jack is Patty's son and my brother, for those of you that are wondering.
She was presumed to have been murdered. I think that's
a given quite, at this point. Yeah.
In 1999, an internal report by the Metropolitan Police criticised the handling of the original investigation and failure to further investigate John Canaan. A new reinvestigation was launched in the early 2000s with a new team whose detectives were directed to determine whether Canaan could be eliminated as a suspect or implicated in Lamplugh's murder.
I mean, I think, again, just going back to it one more time, there is actually no concrete evidence that it was categorically 100% him. However, if you put all the little pieces of the jigsaw together, it really only comes back with one name.
Well, that's what circumstantial evidence is, isn't it? It's where there's nothing, as you say, concrete to pin it down to one person. But murderers have been convicted on circumstantial evidence when there's been the amount or the weight of circumstantial evidence supports the conclusion that, you know, a crime has been committed. These reinvestigations established that Canaan could not be eliminated and discovered more evidence that implicated him. The paper index cards used in the original investigation were computerised because in them days everything was written down. This was another, in the Yorkshire Ripper case, for instance, it was all paperwork, you know, and this is why it was slow and why things were missed as well. But now we're up to the point where, you know, it was all computerised and that's what they did. They did that to enable them to look at it in more detail. And investigators learned that several estate agents in Fulham had been visited at the time by a man calling himself Mr. Kipper.
God, Mr. Kipper's back again.
He is.
Well, it sounds like he was, you know,
Mr. Kipper was doing the rounds, basically.
Putting himself out there to try and see if there was a suitable candidate for what he wanted to do.
I remember reading as well that the estate agents that she worked for, they actually put Susie in the window where people could see her as they walked past because she was an attractive young woman. So she was like bait, really, when you think of it. I mean, I don't think they meant it in that way. It was obviously a selling ploy, and that time there was probably, in those areas, there was lots of estate agents. And, you know, it was kind of a way to get people to come in. And this has, unfortunately, attracted that kind of clientele, let's just say. After new reconstructions were shown on Crime Watch in 2000, including correct pictures of Lamplugh with blonde hair, new witnesses emerged. The witnesses included a man who said that he had seen a man resembling Canaan looking into the window of the estate agency where she worked on the day on which she disappeared. Some witnesses also emerged after police showed Canaan's 1987 dating video, who positively identified him as a man whom they had seen in Fulham that day.
I need to watch this dating video. Is it going to creep me out?
It does a bit, really, yeah. During the reinvestigation of the Lamplugh case, a mass of circumstantial evidence was uncovered that pointed to Canaan. It was discovered that Susie had disclosed to relatives shortly before she disappeared that she had a new boyfriend from the Bristol area, where Canaan had moved days after the disappearance and from where his family originated. Another coincidence?
There's far too many coincidences.
I think not.
In this case.
Lamplugh also told a relative shortly before she vanished that she was concerned about the man and was becoming scared of him.
So she definitely knew him.
She definitely knew
him. There's no doubt about it in my mind that she knew that man that she was meeting at that property. Or she was at least familiar with him.
Canaan denied ever having been to Fulham and did not have an alibi for the days after leaving prison and claimed to not recall where he was at that time, despite having an impeccable memory of other events. Canaan's nickname in prison was
dun, dun, dun.
Mr. Kipper, because he wore Kipper style broad ties. But did he have a pair of 10 toes?
That's a good question.
In December 2000, finally, Canaan was arrested on suspicion of Lamplugh's abduction and murder and interviewed at Hammersmith Police Station. Video footage of part of the interview were later leaked publicly and are still available for public viewing. In the footage, Canaan says that there are one or two things I haven't been called for. Over 5 days of interviews, Conan did not provide interviewers with any information that could eliminate him from the inquiry and did not provide an alibi for his movement between the 25th and 28th of July 1986. In September 2001, Conan was arrested again and questioned at a London police station, but he again provided no information that could eliminate him from the inquiry.
So it sounds to me a little bit now as well that he's like showboating a little bit, saying there's still one or two things that you've not caught me for.
Yeah, I think he knew at that point that they didn't have anything, you know, tangible to link him to it, but were extremely suspicious of him and actually probably at this point knew it was him. I mean, look at the evidence. We all know it was him, I think. And just literally couldn't pin it on him. So he was getting a bit boastful at that point and confident. While in prison, Conan told a solicitor that he might well reveal all about Lamplugh when his mother died. However, in 2020, his brother revealed that his sister had already unsuccessfully begged him to reveal the location of Susie's body, and the brother insists that he will take his secrets to the grave because he doesn't have a modicum of regret, conscience or compassion and is a power freak.
I was just going to say, it sounds like he's kind of reveling in the fact that obviously he knows this information and he knows that he's the only person that does. And, you know, he's kind of stringing the police along a little bit by saying little things here and there, but not actually giving them the information that they need.
You know what this is though, don't you? It's all about power, isn't it? He's got the key to unlocking this mystery. And he's in prison anyway, so I don't think it would make much difference to him at this point. But he wants to still wield that authority and power over his victim and also his victim's relatives and family, etc. Currently, Conan is a Category A offender in HMP Full Sutton, York, where he still protests his innocence to this day. He has studied for an Open University degree while in prison. I wonder what that was in. And I wonder if he called himself Mr. Kipper. Dr. Kipper.
Dr. Kipper. I mean, I think it's bizarre to me that he's still trying to protest his innocence when he's actually dropped little bits of information that have shot himself in the foot along the years.
But don't you think this kind of personality, and again, this is kind of, it sort of mirrors really the Brian Blackwell case we did last week, this kind of narcissistic personality, convince themselves actually of what they are. You know what I mean? He believes it himself at this point, I think.
I wonder if he has narcissalid in prison.
I bet you he does. In September 2023, Conan faced a parole hearing after serving his minimum term of 33 years and 214 days. On 9th of October 2023, the parole board refused to release him and refused to move him from his current Category A prison to open conditions, which would have seen him downgraded to a Category D facility. He remained behind bars.
And I think rightly so as well, because to be honest, I mean, we had this discussion last week after the episode of Brian Blackwell about should he have been released, is he still a danger to the public? And I think, you know, with John Conan, it's very much about, they know he knows the information and he's just choosing not to tell it because obviously he is a psychopath. And how does that make him not a danger to the public? Of course he is.
Well, we can't believe a word Mr. Kipper says, can we?
We definitely can't. And also, you know, if they moved him from a Category A prison to a Category D, it means that he would be eligible to open conditions, which means I would imagine that he can leave and come back at certain times.
Day release. Yeah.
Day release. And you know, if we've learned anything, it's that in 1987 he was on day release and he went and killed Shirley Banks, so there's no reason that he should ever get out of prison, in my opinion.
Well, actually what he was doing was he was using that time to his own benefit to go and literally stalk women, I think. So he was going around bars at night time trying to find victims, basically, and also he was going around to state agents, and he may have changed that sort of mode.
MO,
yeah. And, you know, targeted other things, but he could have still done the same thing, which is what I think he probably would have done. He seemed to like doing it. It was his pattern, wasn't it? The one good thing that did come out after all this, though, was that Susie's mother, Diana, started the Susie Lamplugh Trust, which is a charitable foundation. She established that in December 1986.
So that was actually the same year that her daughter went missing?
Yeah, it was actually mum and dad that started it. Her dad was Paul. Predominantly, the mission of the Trust is to raise awareness of personal safety through training and various projects, and to offer counselling and support to relatives and friends of missing people. The Trust also runs the UK's National Stalking Helpline. Because that was never a thing, was it, at one time? It wasn't taken seriously. And even to this day, you know, it's difficult.
I was just going to say, there's so many cases that I'm sure we've both listened to where people have reported being stalking, they've had evidence of being stalked, and it's really not taken as seriously as it should be.
No, I think they have to move through a series of events before you actually get, and very often it's too late, before they get to a point where there's any help for them. And by that time, a lot of the time it is too late. Paul and Diana Lamplugh were appointed to OBE in 1992 and 2005, respectively, for their charitable work with the Susie Lamplugh Trust. Sadly, Diana Lamplugh died in August 2011 at the age of 75, and Paul Lamplugh died at the age of 87 in June 2018, never really knowing where their daughter was or what had happened to her.
Yeah, I can only imagine what that must have been like for a family, because, you know, they're not around now. Even if there ever is a resolution to the case, they're not going to be here to see that. So they've kind of, you know, they've passed away without ever knowing where her body is, what actually happened. And all this time, this psychopath is sat behind bars knowing all that information. Well, that's what I've kind of taken from this case, is that he definitely does know what happened. He definitely did do it. And he had the opportunity to give her parents, give her family some closure, and he chose not to.
And there's that control thing again, right till the end. He'll probably never say, and this was also the case, by the way, in, you know, the infamous Moors murders, where Ian Brady knew where those kids were buried on the moors, but would never, ever, even to this day, one of his victims, Keith Bennett, is still missing. That child is lying out on the moors, and his mum died not knowing where he was. What would it have been for him to actually, you know, he was in prison, he was never coming out, but he wielded that control right up until the end. And he's dead now, and now no one will ever know unless somebody ever comes across.
And sadly, I think that's going to be the case here. I think that's going to be the case with John Kanaan, is that I think he will take it to his grave.
I do, because he's the same psychopathic mentality, in my opinion anyway.
What a unusually strange case.
It is, but the thing that I take away from this as well is, despite all that they went through, they still managed her parents, I mean Susie's parents, to bring some good out of it at the end. Through all of their suffering, they tried to help other people and set up the Susie Lamplugh Trust, which God knows how many other people that saved. We'll never know, will we? There's probably lots of young women and young people maybe who have been saved by following the guidelines they put in place through their projects and counselling.
I think the bottom line of this case is, never trust a man called Mr. Kipper.
Or any other fish, for that matter.
You know, hopefully in years to come, there will be a resolution to this case, and the family of Susie Lamplugh can finally have some closure. Okay, everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks to all our listeners, and we hope you've learned something new about the case this week, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember,
if you can't do the time,
don't do the crime.